So, what's with all the breaks lately, man?
What do you mean?
I mean, we haven't been doing the show. What are you working?
Yeah, I'm working, but it's
Typical. What else is happening? Life shit? You got life shit going on?
I mean, life shit kind of always happens, though,
Yeah,
so
you
I.
always let that happen because you're selfish. And then there was that time, you made me go on vacation, which I have to say was uncalled for.
I am at a loss for where I don't know where this is coming from. I don't get me wrong, I've really missed suiting up and doing the show too, but I certainly didn't force you in any way to take a lovely vacation with your even lovelier wife. That was all your call.
I'm just messing with you, man.
Oh.
I was doing my best Jeff impression, and that was a pretty good me you were doing, though. I have to ask, am I really that serious? Is that how I come off? So measured, so learned?
I didn't think I was playing the role of you, so I don't know.
Typical Jeff. By the way, what did you mean getting suited up to do the show?
Oh, I have an outfit.
You do? What? Like a special outfit. What is it?
The skin of roughly 19 different streetwalkers and other Insouciant vagrants.
And we're back.
From the Alan Smithy Memorial Studio, this is the Broken Projector Podcast with Scott Beggs and Jeff Latula.
Welcome, everybody, to another punctilious episode of the Broken Projector Movie Podcast. I'm your co-host, Jeff LaTulip.
And I'm your host, Scott Beggs.
First, we do need to apologize for not having a show last week.
And all jokes aside from the cold open, it was my fault. I was driving in some bad weather, had an accident, was kidnapped by Kathy Bates.
She kept you a really long time.
It felt like it.
And how are your feet?
They'll grow back.
Oh, that's good. I just spent my time killing hookers.
The Daily Mail was wrong.
We've got a great show for you this week. Our intrepid interviewer, Jack Giroux, will speak with Oscar-nominated archer Jeremy Renner, and we'll check in with Kate Erbland about the movies from Toronto that you'll want to see when they come to your neighborhood cinema.
We'll also discuss the nature of adulthood in movies, but first, a graciously brief update on the six-week spec challenge, now that we're one-third done with it, which I think that it dawned on me that this is like the terror of doing something at 6 weeks, because at the outset, it feels like it's long enough to matter, and then you get 2 weeks in, and then you get 3 weeks in, and you're like, it's half over. Oh shit.
Yeah. I think that some of the writers are feeling the heat right now, and it's very easy to look at that and say, holy shit, a third of this time has gone. I have like no time left, and get in your head about it, and you can't do that. You just gotta keep pushing through.
Yeah, and so for those that don't know, the six-week spec challenge is a daring feat of writing a spec screenplay within that six-week window. No writing beforehand. Prep beforehand's fine. And Jeff has a cadre of 10 writers who, at the end of this, will get their screenplays up on the blacklist and get some free rankings from them and some free hosting for a short time as well. They were chosen from over 7 million entries. I think it's something like 450.
Chosen 423 or 26, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so chosen to be the top 10, or I guess I shouldn't say top 10, but the people that caught your eye the most.
That would be more accurate. And I guess there's one guy, Lewis, who's one of the writers who I think he has over like 100 pages already, and is close to finishing it. And everybody else has just, you know, very chummily been like, fuck you.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happens when one of you is breaking the curve, right, for the rest of the class. But I mean, at the other time, I have been following the hashtag on Twitter and seeing kind of the writer's concerns and falling into it. And I've unfortunately, like, I've been writing too, and I've been using the hashtag
You say unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've been writing as well. I've been using the hashtag mostly for jokes to claim that
I've seen that.
Negative 10 pages and stuff like that. But in truth, I think that I am not Lewis right now.
Okay.
But I will tell you a couple of things about where I'm at. One is my page count is technically below an average of 3 a day. So I'm not exactly there. But I have been using the time. There are two things that I've kind of clued into, and a lot of it has been breaking the story, which has been difficult. But as I mentioned, the story that I'm working on is only two people in the movie, so it's a little bit more difficult. But I've also been using the time to do more research and reading scripts and watching stuff. And one of the scripts I read was the 30-page script for All Is Lost. which is only Redford. And it was actually really, really great research and really comforting because, you know, as much as we break into it, it's like, oh, 90 pages, that's your script. It was nice to read something at 30 and realize that it could be really powerful at an hour and a half long movie. And so, and for me, that just focuses on dialogue so much, it was nice to read something that was all block text, all action, all action. So that was nice. And it made me realize that, like, I just need to write it at whatever length that's going to organically come to. So
yeah,
that's where I am at currently. And I'm also really hoping, I'm fearing going to Fantastic Fest for the 6 week spec and what it can do to destroy my progress. But I'm also happy to be on two plane rides that will last more than 12 hours.
Yeah, there you go.
So where are you at?
That's a long time.
Yeah, it
is. You know, it's funny because I had a writer write to me just yesterday, a little bit worried because their script only ended up being like 76 pages.
Oh, and yeah, like donezo.
Yeah, yeah. And I said, you know, there's and the question was, you know, what, like, how do you know when it's time to give it over to your inner circle for notes? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the first thing I said was, you know, make sure your inner circle actually knows what they're talking about, or it doesn't matter anyway. But the other thing with that is, you know, when you feel like there's, you can't make it better, there's nothing more that you have to say, that's when you want to hand it over to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just caution that, and I'll caution you in the same way. Generally, you know, unless you have, and I don't want to call it a gimmick script, but, you know, a script where there's no dialogue, or there's something that makes it so that, you know, if it is 30 pages, it can be an hour and a half. If you don't have a script, you know, with a special exception like that, and you get to the end and you have only 76 pages, you've probably done something wrong. And that's just the blunt way to put it. But there's probably, you probably haven't fleshed your story out enough, because you definitely want to have more than you need, as opposed to less not than. Enough.
Can you add dance sequence, or like a...
You could add a really long dance sequence if you wanted to. But even, you know, even the best... The most emaciated horror and comedy scripts need to get to like 85 pages to run the hour and a half. So the great thing about that is, you know, if you only have two guys that are talking, there's going to be a lot of dialogue. I don't think you'll have, you know, a problem getting to a feature length limit. But if you get there and it's only 70 pages or whatever, it's a great opportunity to look back and think, what about the story, if anything, did I miss? What could I have hit harder? What could I have explored more? And then, you know, go back into your story and look at it that way. And it's not that you can't give it to people to look at that point, but you really want to take stock of, like, you know, do I have enough going on here?
Yeah, play what if, and then also think of how you can make it more difficult for your character. Because 14 pages might just be the difference, and it depends on how involved your plotting is or how many characters there are, because that can really... I mean, if you're tightly knit and it's 76 pages, it's difficult to move the Rubik's Cube the right way. But it's also one of those things
where... It's really, have you told us enough of a story?
Yeah, exactly.
Have you told us enough of a screen story?
Yeah, because likely the case is, if you're at 75 or 76 pages, that it's been too easy. A transition, that there's some part missing, and 14 pages may be just the right amount of time to put one more obstacle, maybe the first obstacle, or maybe your medium-sized obstacle in the way, and get to the next point. So
yeah, it just in general, and not always, but in general, it signals that you don't quite have your narrative fleshed out enough.
Yeah.
I'm at a point where I still haven't started, because I'm still working on my assignment, but that's presenting its own interesting challenges in
so
and
you
of
haven't
itself.
Started at all. Do you think you're going to rock this out in 4 weeks?
Oh, I don't have any doubt. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that today was day 10 or day 11. Mm-hmm. I'm saying this on Thursday, so on Friday when this airs, it'll be like day 12 or 13, basically 2 weeks, like you said. I have everything all ready to go for the script that I'm going to write, and it's just a matter of getting this one finished and locked up and sent off and taking a day or two and jumping right back into it.
I would suggest adding a dance number to your current script where it's at right now.
I'm not going to rule it out.
Yeah, that's where we're at right now. You can follow along at hashtag 6 week spec and see how everyone's doing. Right now, if you go to that, it's going to be pretty depressing, so grab some pills or something. But it really is like, how am I going to do this? My hair is ripped out, and
it's gonna really, I mean, the last week is just gonna be hysterical.
Yeah, I hope so.
I think it's going to be really funny. But you can also follow along. We'll be doing an update with the 10 writers that I selected on my blog tomorrow. That's just jefflatulip.com.
So, and next we want to talk a bit about the death of adulthood in culture. And that's a specific title because of the A.O. Scott piece that came out. Just an absolutely fantastic piece, which I appreciate for doing two things well, and that is covering the topic and not covering it completely, because he leaves so much room for the conversation to extend beyond what he's said, and it seems to be working very well. There's no way to boil down what his argument is, so just go read the piece at New York Times Magazine. But, you know, there are some core elements to it. Specifically, he looks at a lot of television, a lot of Judd Apatow, a lot of where we're at with Beyonce, actually, as a role model. And he runs the gamut. I mean, again, this is like an 8,000, 9,000 word, maybe 10,000 word piece. So
it's very well thought out.
No way to boil it down, but it does go into great detail about the concept of adulthood, at least evolving and shifting. I know the headline is a bit, anytime it's like the death of X, it's a little bit ridiculous, but... You know, ultimately, what he's pointing to is a great change that I believe also mirrors cultural change. So I wanted to get your take on it. I mean, are we, for lack of a better term, is adulthood as we knew it before dead within current pop culture?
I mean, I hope so. I mean that quite seriously, because what stood out to me and what I've thought for a long time, actually, so it was great to read this piece that kind of echoed my ideas while also saying them much more eloquently and interestingly, is that, you know, we are the first generation that is really, like, as a whole, not afraid to have fun with their entire lives. Right. And, you know, we came from our parents, but especially from their parents, who it was like, you graduated high school. Not that many people went to college. You generally, like, joined the military or the workforce, and you immediately started having kids and taking things very seriously. And that's not to say that nobody ever had fun, but it was just like there was a major partition between, okay, I was a kid and now I'm an adult.
Right.
And we all saw how there were so many ways that made our parents and grandparents completely miserable, mm-hmm. because they had this belief that it's like, okay, well, I was a kid, I have to go be an adult now, and that means I don't get to have fun anymore, because, like, I watched my dad and my mom and they didn't have fun. They worked all the time. They took things very seriously. Now I have to take things seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would think back to, like, I wear shorts and flip-flops every day, and I think back to—
You don't have, like, a real job.
I definitely don't have a real job, but this goes to the real job thing, because I still feel like I should have the mentality of having a real job. Mm-hmm. And I just started thinking, like, it was like in my late 20s, like, when I hit 30, like, and I seriously thought about this a lot, like, do I have to start, like, wearing button-up shirts and tucking them in, mm-hmm. to pants?
Yeah.
Like, is that the transition I have to make?
Thanks for clarifying pants on that. Tucking them in to pants.
Look, people do a lot of weird things today, and I'm not trying to be judgmental, but there's this whole thing of, you know, just because I am an adult, and I make adult decisions, and I have rent, and I have bills, and all this stuff, that doesn't mean that you have to suck all the joy out of your life and be very, very serious about it. And that's the really cool place that I think the article came from, was looking at these sort of archetypes of what an adult was, you know, throughout sort of our American history, and realizing that, you know, you don't have to have a set of rules. You don't have to have a certain person that you have to be an adult. And you don't have to, adulthood doesn't have to equal not having any fun anymore.
Right. And I think there's two things that I want to, that you bring up that are important. And I think one is the kind of romanticization of what we're going through. And I know that you and I have untraditional, non-traditional jobs, which there is a slight irony in the fact that A.O. Scott is a film critic writing this and a cultural
right.
critic. And then also me, who I'm doing this right now in pajamas. So
right.
I mean, this is where we're at. A.O. Scott, obviously, for the New York Times, has to wear button-up shirts, and he probably has to tuck them into pants too. But
that poor bastard.
I don't know if that he has to do it all the time though. So, but the romantic, you know, glamorization process is one that, like, okay, you know, you even joke around about not having a real job and wearing flip-flops and stuff, but the truth is that you take it seriously as a business also. You have to be business-minded. This is my career, you know, because everyone who doesn't, I mean, that's the difference between success and 99.9% of everyone else. You know, this is a hobby. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do what I'm doing this because I want a vacation permanently, and that's not correct.
Right.
And so the other part of it is that when you look back at, you know, our grandparents' generation, and we should both note that we're 30 plus. Our grandparents' generation, God love them, fought in World War II, fought in Korea, and then
they lived in a really, really, really serious world.
They lived in a post-Depression world where things were very different. A lot of them grew up in the Depression and then pushed beyond that, and it was about providing and making sure that everyone had enough.
Right.
You know, and then beyond that, you know, I feel we can stereotype our parents' generation in that sort of late 70s, 80s mold of, wow, our parents provided a shit ton for us. We have great educations now. We can make stupid amounts of money. What are we going to do with that?
Right.
And it was like the spoils of war all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And that's why cocaine is a great icon for that era.
Yep. By the way, also in that same mindset was, got to give the kids all the things I didn't have.
Then,
but you forget to provide them with structure and figuring out how to get those things on their own.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, yeah, we've made it in a sense. We've succeeded. We're here. Mm-hmm. And this is never going to go away. We're just going to maintain.
Right.
And, you know, for us, I grew up in a lower middle class kind of atmosphere. And there was both that mixture of, hey, you need to work and make sure that you have a plan. And also, hey, go have fun, figure it out for yourself and be creative. And my parents were very supportive of figuring out what I wanted to do. But we get to the end road here. And I feel like our generation is living in this zone where we weren't necessarily hampered by our grandparents' ideology, because we didn't grow up with them directly influencing us. So, the idea of going to an office, and that's the other thing is, you know, our grandparents doing jobs, it was really fantastic economy at the time where they were pushing through and built it to be amazing. And post-World War II, it became this powerhouse and there was a lot of energy there. Now working in an office is bullshit. It is oppressive and terrible. And they want you to work on weekends without getting overtime. And you, just because everyone else is trying to get ahead, you have the herd mentality of doing that. So yeah, of course there's a natural backlash and people like us increasingly are saying, no, I want to go do something that's more fulfilling personally. And I want to figure out a way to not make $100,000 a year, but I'll gladly make $36,000 a year doing it. And
there's a huge dichotomy. And there's a huge dichotomy there because you want to tell people, like, go after something that you care about, go after something that you're going to enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. But that's not a realistic thing for most people.
Yeah. And I mean, the flip side of this coin that I want to point out, and again, this only dents what A.O. Scott is saying, because, you know, the thing is just broad and expansive and wonderful. But when we talk about, like, Judd Apatow, the characters, when you look at these kind of movies, it's easy to be like, oh, man-child, especially like 40-year-old mm-hmm. virgin, right? But what does mm-hmm. he have? He has a steady job. He knows how to dress himself and feed himself. He has everything figured out except this one part of his life. And so for the most part, when you look at a lot of these movies, people are immature, but a lot of them, other than maybe like Knocked Up, you know, is a case where like, these men have it figured out. They have jobs. They have these, you know, on this level of adulthood, they're good, but we don't think about them that way because they are very immature and maybe they don't know how to treat a woman or they don't have a child or et cetera.
Well, I think the key thing here is that it's fits of immaturity and not necessarily immaturity as a character trait. Right. I mean, for some, definitely. But for others, it's like, you know, they compartmentalize enough to know that it's like, okay, weekend in Vegas, this is a time I can be a 14-year-old douche mm-hmm. and get away with it. And that's okay, because I think that one of the things that is good about the change society is going through is that we figured out you don't have to be one kind of person all the time.
Right.
You know, you can be one person in business. You can be one person in your home life. You don't have to. There's no box that you have to force yourself into. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's been incredibly freeing for some people and incredibly terrifying for others.
Yeah. And I mean, Scott mentions Louis as well. And, you know, mm-hmm. he specifically talks about the idea that, you know, every white heterosexual male under 50 becomes, you know, is portrayed
some
in the
version
show
of him. Yeah.
At some point. And what I love about that is that Louis exaggerates his failures on the the program as a character named Louis, I should say.
Right.
But Louis C.K. has created this character who has exaggerated problems, exaggerated issues. He is obvious. He's terrible, and he says the wrong things at the right time. And
right.
At the end of the day, though, when you look at the core structure of his adulthood, he's got it all figured out. He has a job, which he takes seriously. He takes care of his kids. Mm-hmm. He had a marriage that dissolved, and he's dealing with it. I mean, this is a guy who has a great heart, who also has a terrible black section of it, and he's just trying to figure out the world around him
and because
it hasn't been defined previously for him. But otherwise, the foundations of adulthood are there for the character.
No, I agree completely. And the great thing about Louis is that he, I think, is the other side of the coin, where it's like he does kind of have it figured out, and he seems to be happy about none of it.
Right. Yeah.
And so there's also that too. So, you know, when we talk about man children, you know, I think that it's pretty much a literal thing. Like if anybody has Peter Pan syndrome, I certainly do. But I'm also able to get my work done and be a productive human, and you know, maybe someday a reproductive human. And if God had falls asleep at the wheel or something like that. And so, like, I look at that and I can say, well, I'm happy. And at the end of the day, you know, even if there's some immaturity to you or whatever you want to call it, if you're productive and you take care of the people that you love, like, isn't it good that people are happy?
Yeah, exactly. And I think
that would be my argument for the change being a good thing.
Yeah. And I think my argument for the change being the bad thing is the question mark, the variable at the end of the sentence that we don't know. And that is that, you know, this is more than just young adult fiction taking over. And this is more than just Scott, you know, cringing when he sees someone 50 years old, you know, holding Harry Potter books. It's it's the kind of thing where, again, when we look at a generation, we're not just judging a generation or a culture, we're judging how it's going to affect the next generation. And I know that there's a lot of concern over young millennials, because I am a millennial. You may have missed the cutoff, but who cares? It's like several years different. But they're
still Gen X.
The idea that, you know, all those people being bar mitzvahed right now who weren't alive during 9/11 are going to inherit a culture where they're getting mixed messages about how to define adulthood. And, you know, the question is, where do they go from there? And this is where real life kind of shows us where we've been having our cultural conversations. And that is, you know, we have a higher rate of post-college people living with their parents. We have a higher rate of joblessness than other generations have had to deal with. And so the interesting thing to me
is
that
part of that also, you have to look at that practically and say part of that also is that the cost of going to college and pursuing higher education has increased by like 3,000,000% in the last 30 years. And now people are just saddled with debt.
And becoming 3,000,000% less important. I mean, it's the kind of thing, less meaningful, I should say, because you have to have the piece of paper, but what does that mean?
Right.
But the other question is this. I mean, on the one hand, you could think, okay, our culture, as we're defining it right now through our art and the way that we're judging our lives based on that art and being influenced by it, maybe you can see a younger generation that is going to be lost completely, that they will not understand at all how to be responsible citizens or productive citizens or reproductive citizens. And the flip side to that is, okay, well, you know, our grandparents and our great grandparents who lived through a depression and lived through high rates of joblessness, you know, pushed through it and survived and, you know, came to thrive, in fact. And I think that there is a silver lining there, but it's also, again, the variable of all of this is, you know, we can't just go build factories and roads and do the AAA and all this, you know, public's work stuff. We're in a new economy where, like, how do you go create a new cultural hub? Like, what is the next industry that we can just go steroidal on in order to
and
get everyone jobs?
And how long will it last?
And how long will it last? Yeah. So it's like, okay, well, let's teach everyone how to code. Well,
right.
And I think that the establishment is going to say, well, what the fuck's that going to do? And people like me are like, we don't know, but it could be amazing.
Yeah, it's going to be, and it, you know, all of this sort of leads back to what A.O. Scott is talking about, where it's just going to be fascinating to see how that's reflected in our fictional media. I mean, like, what, you know, when 30 years from now, when I'm 65, if I make it there, let's not count any chickens. But when I'm looking back and I'm 65 and I'm looking back on all this, like, what am I going to, like, what am I going to think of what's being produced as a reflection of this, you know, society that I left to these people?
Right, right. I mean, how do you feel about that? You're not just a consumer of culture, you are a creator. You have created art that's been seen by people. So, and you've created what is very a timely adult question. How do I find love and how do I maintain it?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's tough to say because the people that made that movie with me, we most of us had the singular focus of like, let's reflect what's going on now. Let's reflect what people are feeling and how they work it out, and at least give them the chance to sort of look back on themselves and hopefully maybe try to figure it out. So, you know, what we did, I think, was very of the moment. Not that you won't be able to watch it in 20 years, hopefully, and think like, well, that really speaks to what I'm doing. But it's tough to say because I don't think we set out to say anything more than that or you know, express some kind of big ideal or anything. So it'll be interesting to see if anybody even knows what it is 5 years from now or 10 years from now.
Yeah, it can change so quickly.
Yeah.
But I think when we look at like the case of what television is showing us right now, where like there is a world that was dominated by shows like Breaking Bad and Girls and Nurse Jackie and Sopranos and these kind of bad characters, quote unquote, or amoral characters.
Mm-hmm.
The other argument here is that, one, it's great to see stories where people are attempting to figure it out because that's what all stories are and that's what they've always right. been. And then two, we may be really addicted to these kind of shows or we may be bolstering their popularity because we don't have that in real life. We don't have the ability to be President Underwood. We don't have that skill set or that openness or the balls to be crazy amoral and shove a girl in front of a train. And so right. these are the over dramatizations of what we, what our id is asking for, and we get it in our art, and then we go do our job the next day, and we're
there's
fine.
There's definitely a lot of what would happen if I broke down, or what would happen if society around me broke down.
Yeah.
That's what you're seeing in a lot of these shows, and I think it's, you know, it's a really interesting counterpoint to stuff from the 50s and 60s, which was glossy and candy coated and just completely saccharine. I think because coming off of, you know, the Depression, the generation that's making these shows, it's like, you know, you want to show the good side of life rather than wallow in the bad side. And now maybe that we've, you know, had all these advances in technology and medicine and people are living longer and hopefully better, and we've got all these newfangled things around, maybe now we're obsessed with like, well, what happens when that all goes bad?
Yeah.
So it's a really, like I said, it's a really interesting juxtaposition of looking at it's at least as much about where you came from as where you are now.
Right. And there's also an element where like we can look at the news and see that the world is falling apart.
Right.
Not to say the sky is falling. I've seen that over and over and over in commentary, and I want to remind them that like just the world falls apart every 4 years. So that's
absolutely. That's yeah. We're just seeing more of it now.
Yeah. And that's the reality is, okay, bad things are happening all over the world. If I can tell me something new.
That goes back to one of those stats, like, cause you're absolutely right. And it goes back to one of those stats, like where you talk about, okay, well, over the last 30 years, autism, you know, cases have exploded by, like, there's 10,000% more autism now than there was in 1970. And yeah, there is, but that's only because they figured out how to classify it and diagnose people better. And there's not like any more of a rate of it in humanity. It's not like, oh my God, autism is growing. It's we just recognize it more, which is another huge thing in media.
And we're 20 cases away from eradicating polio completely. So, I mean, right. we deal with different things in different generations. You know, there are yep. always monsters to deal with, and these are ours.
Yeah.
But it's also the case that when you look at something like TV, and okay, granted, there is always a bias toward a strong central figure in a lot of storytelling, so it may be meaningless, but when we're looking at different shows, like as diverse even as like The Mindy Project and Game of Thrones or House of Cards, or, you know, these super amoral deals, especially House of Cards, mm-hmm. you have characters who, in response to the world around them, have the bravery and the lack of morals, frankly, but the bravery to affect great change. in their moment. And then you have like something like the Mindy Project, where it's basically self-focused, but it's also that she's active, she's doing things, and things are funny, and she gets into trouble, and it's, this is life. And I know that there's always been an element of that in sitcoms where, you know, we are not experiencing it, and then we see it in artwork and say, hey, this person's so like active and adventurous, and she gets into trouble, and that's the price you pay for doing new things. But at the same time, it works in great contrast to a world that is scary in the nonfiction sense, that we see characters and worship characters who are strong enough to like put their big boy pants on and go into the fight and change.
And you know, it's you're absolutely right, and it's so funny because I have an idea in mind, but I want to ask you, like, comedy, drama, horror, whatever it is, maybe not horror, but like, especially when we're talking about TV and the exact types of characters that you're thinking of, what would you say, like, if you had to pick one thing, what would you say is the genesis of that?
Of like all of these characters?
A character, a show, an idea, like if you had to pinpoint, okay, that's where the culture changed and made way for exactly the type of character that you're talking about, that's not afraid to go out there and just completely like break barriers, what would you say that would be?
Tough to say. I think that Scott has a really good option here in the modern era, because again, it's happened over time and time and time again. But I think Tony Soprano is a good launch pad for that, certainly. Mm-hmm.
If you go back even further, here's what I'm going to opine.
Okay.
If you go back even a little bit further, I swear to God, I think it all goes back to Seinfeld.
Okay, I can see that.
You have these four people who are, I mean, like, genuinely awful, self-absorbed dickheads who just do whatever they want with very little care for anybody else. Mm. And it was so... I think, so cathartic for people to see that and not say like, oh man, I can go out and be a complete asshole too, but that you can sort of take back some of your world for yourself, mm-hmm. like these characters did, because they just didn't care. I think that it has permeated every fictional piece of media that's come since.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. And it feels a lot like the rusty lining of all of this. I don't know what the opposite of a silver lining is. the rusty lining of all of this.
That's pretty good, yeah.
Is that when I look back at a movie like Network that really tapped into the anger and aggression of the common person in the 1970s, and the idea of yelling out your window how pissed off you were about everything.
Right.
I think that, yes, this time that we're having right now is one that we are responding to some outward pressure with a bit of childishness, which is fine, mm-hmm. a bit of childlikeness as well. But I think that the people playing dodgeball also go to staff jobs, you know, that there is a greater balance than we might be offering to this broader picture of a lost generation, quote unquote. And I do think that they have, both in real life and in artwork, a way to create an evening point for both what they can do to make money and what they can do to have fun, and how they're going to define what adulthood means. And I think that when the difficulty here, especially when you look at all of the artwork that he is mentioning in this piece, there is a thread here between people who have children and people who don't.
Yep.
And that is, and I know it's a dichotomy that I notice a lot, because I'm in that age range where every Facebook picture on my feed is a baby. Babies mm-hmm. all over the place. And I know that that is traditionally been the last thing that you do. I mean, no kidding. Like, that's the list is, you know, you grow up and then you have kids, and then what? You retire at some point, and then you're done with your job, and then you die, and that's it. And so you've passed on, you know, you have spread your seed, and it is ready to be out there, and you're done. Technically, evolutionarily, your job is over.
And, you know, it's funny that you bring that up, because Teresa, my girlfriend, and I have had the conversation, and I bet you've had one like it too, because we're older than most of our friends, you know, who have chosen to have kids. We're not older than them, but we've waited longer. I've gotten past thinking that like people who have kids are miserable, because they aren't. They're just situationally miserable in different ways than we are. But you do see the way having kids, you know, affects your life, and it's inevitable, and you can't change change it. You just have to do the best you can with it. But we've had several conversations where we'll look at each other and it's like, you know, when we have kids, let's make a like an absolute promise to ourselves right now and remember this, that we always make time for ourselves. Uh-huh. You see so many people not doing that. And I wonder like how many generations before us had that conversation, if any ever.
And, you know, it's I feel like it's a matter of balance, which everything yeah, will be. Yep,
absolutely.
And you can see that. And that's what is encouraging when we look at the, you know, the TV and the movies and the books, because for as much as we can harp on the young adult fiction explosion that's happened within the last 5 years or so, the truth about it is that what are these stories really about? Well, they're coming of age stories, which have always been popular. And right. they're also stories about young people learning to grow up. So right. at the end point, if we call this young adult fiction, fine. And yeah. maybe it's silly to say, like, if you're reading YA and that's all you're reading and you're an adult, maybe your reading comprehension needs to be buffered up a bit. But at the same time, the stories themselves are not about frivolousness. The stories themselves yeah. are about achieving against great odds and becoming something of a mature human being. And I would say a hyper-mature human being, given some of the subject matter, like Hunger Games, for example.
Yeah, it's all about moving on from the place where you're at now.
Exactly. And so, you know, when it comes to the question of children and that sort of thing, like, yeah, we went through and probably still go through from time to time this idea that we're being selfish somehow in not having yeah. children. But at the same point, we have friends here. And again, being in Europe makes it probably even more frustrating. And the line gets right. drawn really boldly between people who have kids and just feel miserable about having, you know, this anchor,
right.
a joyous, wonderful miracle of an anchor. right. And then also people like us who are just like, I mean, we have dogs, so it's like, call the kennel, we'll set him up, no problem. right. And then right. we go travel to Amsterdam or whatever. But then at the same yeah. time, like, we have friends who had a kid about a year ago and they promised that it would not slow them down, and they've been everywhere and they just yeah. sling the baby, they take care of the kid totally fine, but they've found ways to go have adventures with the kid in tow, which is another element of just amazing. I mean, that's something we don't see in our artwork hardly at all. And if there is a problem with maturity, I would argue that's one of them, is that when we yeah. look at these stories,
yeah.
it is about Don Draper going to work and leaving his children behind. It is Tony right. Soprano going to work and leaving his children behind. It is Louis C.K. going to work and leaving his children behind.
Yeah.
You know, it's Sex and the City with no kids, really, until later.
It's so refreshing to see something like Modern Family, where you have Phil Dunphy, who fucking loves his kids.
Yeah, just loves the hell out of them. And the idea yeah. is that, you know, there is not much in art when it comes to maturity, the definition of how do I be a productive human and bring my kid along? How do I have adventures right. and bring my child along? And
right.
prove
why
the family
can't I
unit.
Enjoy the same things that they're enjoying?
Exactly. And, you know, it's that is, I think, where we're going to grapple toward. And what yeah. Scott is pointing out is, again, we are in a moment of flux where we are trying to figure ourselves out. But we always kind of are. So
yeah. And I think maybe the most important thing, and hopefully we'll all realize this at some point, is that you don't have to be just one or the other.
No. Yeah, exactly.
You know, you have your choice of what kind of person, what kind of parent, what kind of consumer you want to be. And you can be active. Like, you don't have to just be taken away by things. You can be active about it and make choices, and you probably should.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other kind of great thing here is that television and film and books offer us a wide array of things to check out. So if you're watching Girls and think, wow, selfish assholes and things are funny and sexual, then, you know, that's great. You can change the channel and see Modern Family. And it's a different
right,
kind
exactly.
of view.
Right, exactly. And can I say one other thing? Because I think this is really important.
Yeah.
The people who are playing dodgeball and kickball have severe emotional problems. Like, we can agree on that, right? That's where I'm going to draw my line in the sand. Like, if you're in your 30s and you're like, yeah, join our kickball league, I know not to be friends with you.
Yeah, but what an arbitrary line in the sand, though, is my point.
Is it really that arbitrary if you think about it?
I think it is arbitrary. I mean,
put on a headband and come kick this rubber ball.
It's fun as shit, dude. You should go try it.
I played kickball in middle school. I had
in
my
middle school, dude. I bet if you got on the field right now and kicked that ball, you'd be transformed.
I'm too fat to do any of that.
We got to the core issue then.
There it is.
It's all about your relationship with your mother.
Pretty, yeah. It's I love food more than food loves me.
We want to know your opinion on all of this. Obviously, we would like you to write a 20,000-word dissertation and email it to us, because this is...
Yeah, my God, compete with us, for Christ's sake.
This is the large question of how we define ourselves through the prism of culture. And if we're doing it right now, it's an interesting moment. You know, it makes me want to watch old episodes of Dick Van Dyke and go to
yeah.
bed. But
by the way, what a great man child.
Yeah, Dick Van Dyke, yet again, another man child on that show. Yep. So let's have some perspective for how long man children have been around, and lady children as well.
They're coming out in force.
They are. They always have been. Email us, podcast@filmschoolrejects.com. You can go to Twitter @BrokenProjector, and you can go to BrokenProjectorPodcast.com as well. Toronto International Film Festival just wrapped up, and our own Kate Erbland was there for the festivities. You literally just walked in the door from the airport, and you're ready to give a report on the movies you saw. So, Kate, thank you so much for taking the time out.
No problem. I have not even unpacked my suitcase yet. I've barely cuddled my cats.
Well,
I'm here.
Give the cat a quick squeeze, and then let's talk about some of the movies. We'll break them up into convenient categories. What we want to do is contextualize it for you, the listener, in a way that will matter for you, because we don't want to talk about even the best movies at Toronto that you will never get to see, because they will just stay on shelves somewhere or in very limited release. But we do want to talk about the best of the best that will be coming to you at some point. So let's start there. Let's just go generically, favorites of the festival.
My top two favorites are definitely Nightcrawler, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, and Noah Baumbach's latest, While We're Young.
Okay, so two vastly different movies, I would wager.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm looking forward to Nightcrawler. I'm going to see it at Fantastic Fest next week. And it just looks like Jake Gyllenhaal gets to be, and I know this gets tossed out all over the place, but it's like Taxi Driver meets Network. So
it's like, I think I wrote down, it's like Taxi Driver, Network, the King of Comedy, yeah. All sort of that stuff. He's, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal being kind of skeezy. I think if you read the script, you'd be like, this guy is very unlikable, but Jake sells it. And so you're sort of on his side, even though you feel like, oh, he's a terrible person.
And he's got dreamy eyes.
He's got dreamy eyes and good hair.
But so can you tell us a little bit about the plot of how, like, what skeevy Jake Gyllenhaal is doing?
Jake Gyllenhaal is sort of a grifter. His character's name is Lou Bloom, and Lou is a grifter and a thief. We see him stealing, like, copper wire and trying to break into train tracks to steal whatever you could steal off of train tracks.
right.
He's clearly, like, a quick study. He talks about learning things online. He's a smooth talker. He's a fast talker. And one night while he's out stealing things to sell, he comes upon a car accident on the highway. And while he's there, Bill Paxton shows up with a camera crew, and they're filming all this stuff, and Lou just thinks it's interesting, and he later finds out that Bill Paxton is a freelance crime videographer. Basically, there's this whole class of people in Los Angeles, I assume other cities, that are called nightcrawlers, who go around and film gory, grisly crimes and then sell their tapes to the networks. And Lou decides that's what he's going to do.
Yeah, why wouldn't you? Naturally.
Right, exactly.
So, appropriately skeevy, and we'll mention it. It's from Dan Gilroy, who has an interesting background, I think. He's a writer for Bourne Legacy, for The Fall, which I absolutely love without hesitation, and Real Steel, he was a writer on as well, a credited writer on Real Steel. So it's a really varied background, and yet here it sounds something very uncomfortable.
Yes, and the movie also co-stars Rene Russo, who is Gilroy's real-life wife. She plays the news director of a station where Lou starts selling most of his tapes, and she has this really great, complex, funny, strange role. She's very excellent in the film.
And I believe your special man friend, Mike Ryan, spent 15 minutes in bed interviewing her, if I'm not
He did. They had a wonderful time. So that's one that he's absolutely allowed to get in bed with Rene Russo, as long as they're just talking about movies.
Oh, she's on the list.
She's on the list.
So that actually comes out October 31st, so you don't have to wait too long for it. So let's talk about your other favorite, While We're Young, from Noah Baumbach. And actually, I couldn't find a specific release date for this, but I believe you have some information on that.
Yes, the film was bought by A24 during the festival, and my understanding is that they will be releasing it next year, sometime in the spring, probably April or May.
And A24 continues to crush it and look for specifically character-driven and performance-driven films. So they are a young outfit, but they had a hell of a year, and they seem to be building on it quite well. So
yeah, I think they're a good fit. They seem very excited about it.
So tell me a little bit about this movie. What made you love it?
Well, I love Noah Baumbach's films anyway. Like, that sense of humor just works for me. The movie is about Ben Stiller, who plays a documentary filmmaker who's sort of been struggling to make one film for about a decade. And his wife is played by Naomi Watts. They kind of have their stuff together. Not really. Most of their friends have kids, and they don't have kids. They don't feel very connected to them. And they meet this very hip young couple that's played by Amanda Seyfried and Adam Driver. And they all become friends. And there's all this interesting, you know, knocking together of these older people who are hip but like modern things, and the young hipsters who like make their own ice cream and are really into their vinyl record collection. So it's just interesting to see those things juxtaposed, and Ben Stiller getting to be funny for Baumbach again, but not being like a bad person like he was in Greenberg. Everyone in the film is likable, but they are layered people, and it's very funny.
So the description you have makes me think of it as Noah Baumbach's version of Neighbors.
Yeah, it actually is sort of like that. Adam Driver wears a lot of stupid hats, but he really sells them. And you kind of see how they become like each other. Ben Stiller starts wearing a hat. Naomi Watts starts going to hip-hop dance class with Amanda Seyfried.
Naturally.
Yeah. But the sort of rub of the situation is that Adam Driver's character also wants to be a documentary filmmaker.
Ah.
So you kind of have to, you start wondering early about their motives for becoming friends.
Well, okay, so let's move beyond just your favorites of the festival. What surprised you? What did you go into either not expecting much from or not knowing a lot of, and then being really, really wowed?
First up is Wild, which before I even see a movie, I like to try and not have my opinions tainted, but Wild did premiere at Telluride right before Toronto, and if you're on Twitter as much as I am, you're going to see tweets with headlines about how people like the film. So I went in thinking it's not great, and I ended up really liking it. I think Reese Witherspoon is great in it. It's a very unfussy, natural performance. It's awards caliber without being in like, oh, hey, I'm an awards movie. Look
nice
at
showy.
Me.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not showy at all.
Not bait.
No, not bait.
And it is, I mean, there's a pedigree here as well. The director, Jean-Marc Vallée, was, his name is probably far silkier than I make it, but from Dallas Buyers Club, of course. And this is from Nicholas Hornby writing with and about Cheryl Strayer, I believe.
Strayed.
Strayed.
Okay. There's actually a moment in the film where they clarify that.
Strayed. So I need to see the movie in order for it to be clarified for me. But and literally all I know about this film is it's Reese Witherspoon has a backpack and she's walking around.
She has a huge backpack. Yeah. She played. It's based on Cheryl Strayed's book of the same name. Cheryl Strayed had some personal issues that you learn about in the film via flashback, and she decided to sort of literally walk away from her life for a little bit and hike the Pacific Crest Trail from Mexico to Oregon. It's like 1,100 miles. It's going to take her about 3 months. And it's about her walking and sort of the people she meets, but also about coming to terms with the things that have happened in her life that made her think, I need to walk alone for 3 months.
Mm-hmm. So this is going to make the good three play with Forrest Gump and Into the Wild.
Yes, there's the walking theme. Yeah. It's very big here. Someone make a list right now.
I'm really hoping that Reese Witherspoon's final lines are, I'm really tired. I think I'll go home now. And so what was another movie that really just surprised you?
Well, it's funny. The festival obviously had a lot of biopics because they get this award season stuff, and we get a lot of the biopics for that. And so I was looking forward to the Stephen Hawking biopic, The Theory of Everything, but it ended up being just so much more lovely and beautiful and, you know, difficult than I had anticipated. It's mainly about Stephen Hawking, who's played by Eddie Redmayne. From the time that he's like working towards his PhD, he's still in school. Obviously, he discovers that he has ALS, and it's when he has just met the woman who will become his first wife, who's played by Felicity Jones, and about the two of them trying to hold their marriage together as he deteriorates physically, but his mind still stays sound.
And you've got kind of a great host of people here involved too. James Marsh, director, who I will admit, after seeing Shadow Dancer, I just want to see him regularly churn out work. And also, you mentioned Felicity Jones, Emily Watson, David Thewlis, some veteran performers adding to the environment here. And what was your favorite part about the film? Is it a tough one? I mean, is it like, am I going to cry? Is what I'm trying to, yes, what I'm stumbling no, around. Okay, will yes, I cry at this?
You are going to cry. I actually started crying within maybe the first 20 minutes.
Fantastic. Bodes well.
Yeah. As you're sort of like, obviously, I assume that most people will go into this film knowing who it's about and what it's about. Mm-hmm. And sort of building up to the discovery of his disease, just knowing what's going to happen. And they're having this lovely little courtship, and they're so nice and young and filled with hope and promise. And you start seeing his handshake, and it's like, it's just over. Mm. And then I cried at the end. It has a beautiful ending that, you know, when you see films like this, you kind of have to wonder, oh, where is it going to end? How are they going to do that? And I think that Marsh does a fantastic job with where the film ends. So right. Yes, you'll cry. Everyone will cry.
How to find grace in an impossibly difficult situation. Yeah. Always a challenge. So we'll bring Tissues. That comes out on November 7th, so we definitely will see that. I know that's going to be, I mean, both Wild and Theory of Everything are also probably going to push decently hard for awards. Wild comes out December 5th. So the last thing on the agenda here is what just dropped your jaw? And I'm not talking about the stuff that pleasantly surprised you, but the stuff that was just what the fuck style crazy.
Well, there is another Adam Driver starring film. I think he had three at the festival. Yeah,
I think they bought him an apartment or something to hang out there for the next 3 weeks.
They're just going to keep him there for a month. It's called Hungry Hearts by Severo Costanzo, who I was not familiar with. And Adam Driver stars in it along with another actress, Alba Rohrwacher, who play a couple that meet. They have this sort of terrible meet cute, and then they get married and things are lovely. She gets pregnant. The first act is relatively straightforward. You think this is going to be a lovely story, and then his wife starts exhibiting signs that she's not taking care of her pregnant body and eventually their baby in the best way that she can. And it becomes them sort of battling each other while still loving each other and trying to take care of their baby. Mm. But somewhere with about 30 minutes into it, it turns almost into a Midnight Madness movie. It starts being filmed and lit like a horror film. The score gets really like scary. It's almost like a haunted house film. And they're both kind of cast as different monsters.
So definitely a bizarre element
yes.
to it.
Yes.
So I'm naturally afraid of Adam Driver. Is this movie going to exacerbate that problem? Like, I watch him in interviews where he's charming, and I'm still frightened.
I mean, I think it's funny because he's not the sort of character that we've seen from him. He's not trying to be overly charming. He's basically like a regular guy who then is trapped in this impossible situation. But he definitely has some scary moments where you're like, oh, okay, Adam Driver, you could hurt someone.
I already believe that.
Yeah, this is not going to help you. You will fear him more, but you might like him more too.
Yeah, I'm already starting at the 100-meter mark on running away from Adam Driver. So. Well, I think that's a great list there. Just to recap, While We're Young, Nightcrawler, Wild, Theory of Everything, and Hungry Hearts, which has no release date yet, but wouldn't be surprised, especially with Adam Driver attached to it, that it will get some kind of release at some point. And now through the magic of the internet, we all know that it's pretty easy to find that stuff. So, Kate, I know you're tired. Give the cat a hug. Thank you so much both for covering the hell out of Toronto and sharing your insights with us here.
Oh, well, it was my pleasure.
Get some rest.
I will. Thank you.
Since bursting onto the major stage with The Hurt Locker, Jeremy Renner has done a fantastic job balancing his prestige roles with the blockbuster genre work of shooting arrows alongside Iron Man and helping out Special Agent Tom Cruise. His latest is Kill the Messenger, directed by Michael Cuesta. It tells the real-life story of journalist Gary Webb, who blew the whistle on the CIA for arming Contra rebels, and who was subsequently targeted by a horrific smear campaign which almost destroyed his life and livelihood. Jack Giroux sat down with Renner at a hotel bar to discuss the work. Here's that interview.
Well, thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it. I'd say it's a great year for you with The Immigrant in this as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm very, very, very happy that I was able to like do like American Hustle and The Immigrant and a movie like this too, to layer in with the the big guys, you know?
Right, and switch things up, I imagine.
Well, I started my career, and that's how I still consider myself as an actor. And I've been very blessed with the big movies, but I feel like people only recognize me. He's like, oh, you're an action hero. You're an action hero. I'm like, well, actually,
Robin Holden.
Yeah, is that too. Same director.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And, but no, I've been very blessed with the opportunities and the big movies, which I love. And then, you know, I also have a soft spot for these kind of stories.
Well, what I think really works about these kind of stories is that a lot of bio films are usually like clip notes where I feel like you get a sense of who Gary Webb is in the movie before the film started. Like, it just tells one complete story.
Yeah. That was important to me, and that's kind of the story we ultimately wanted to tell, is of Gary, and as a journalist, as a husband, as a father, as a flawed hero, if you will, but flawed. I love the sort of every man in extraordinary circumstances is this, and the themes of David and Goliath. I mean, I love that kind of underdog kind of tale.
I imagine when you play someone like Dahmer, it is almost restricting, where a lot of people associate things with him, like, you know what kind of guy he was like. I was wondering, for Webb, is it a little bit more freeing as a performer?
There's always limitations. There's a double-edged sword when you have to play somebody that really existed, regardless if they're famous or not, or well-known, or you can pick them out of a crowd or not. There's still, you want to be truthful to the person and to whatever it was they were involved in. With Dahmer, there's a lot of preconceived things. I was lucky because I didn't know a lot about him, so I didn't have to wipe away all the judgments or thoughts or opinions I had of somebody. But there's a roadmap that you get easily. Boom, here's all these wonderful things and access to things that you don't have to just make up if it's a fictional character. So that's the great part. But also the negative part of it is that you have a roadmap and you can't veer too far off of it. Otherwise, it starts to be dishonest. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword, but it's a lovely thing.
And I know this is your first produced film. I was wondering, you know, what made you want to get into producing actually from the start?
You know, ultimately I started a production company to acquire content that I really wanted to do that the studios just don't make anymore, but they're still worthy of being on the big screen. And so we started acquiring material that I really wanted to do. This would be a little harder to make because it's not in the studio pipeline. You know, we're not wearing masks or capes or doing any of that kind of stuff. And there's not talking robots. And, you know, it's just like they're tougher stories to tell, but they're worthy and need to be told. So this is it's important for me and for me as an actor. And I think there's still audiences that want this.
Right, how was the first experience as a producer? What kind of surprised you
about
it?
It was great. You know, it surprised me of how ready and prepared I was for it, because it's a lot like home building. It's putting out fires, not literal fires, but like you have to be really good at coming up with solutions to 1,000 problems that happen in one day. And the next day it'll be another 1,000 problems and you have to come with solutions for them. So I was always kind of prepared for that because of the home building experience. And then there was the side of it where for me, it was aggregating a cast. It was a giant cast, and it's asking a lot of really great, talented people to come in for a day or 2 days or 3 days. And I don't know if it was a favor to me or if I begged them. I'm sure I begged many of them, threatened to wash their car for a year and, you know, something ridiculous. But it was assembling the team to push this rock up the hill together, because it was all a unified force to make that happen.
Right, and with the producing, and as you mentioned, the home building and acting, are you just someone who likes to stay busy, or is it just different forms of creative fulfillment?
It's both. It's a little, it's some quality control that you have a little bit more say in as a producer on it. But yeah, I do like to stay busy. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Does that make the process of acting different? Like, as you mentioned, all the problem solvings, I imagine.
Yeah, great. Okay. Thank you.
I imagine between takes, you are having to focus on those problems versus the performance.
No. For when it came down to actually shooting, because I am in every frame of the dang movie, every scene, so I can't sit there and concern myself with the producer stuff at that point. Once we started shooting, it's like I had to do all my stuff prior. Then it's just about me and Questa trying to finesse the performance or whatever it might be. So again, assembling the right team, then you can overcome any obstacle that's in front of you. Again, I guess the producer hat was taken off because I had to go perform and do my job.
And as you said, a lot of these movies that you're trying to produce is that a lot of studios usually aren't going to go for them. I was wondering, what are some of the movies that when you look at or watch that you just think, like, those are the kind of movies I want to make?
Like, a lot of movies from the 70s are my favorite. And this is, you know, has a lot of tones of, like, movies from the 70s. So this is a great example for what for the company and what, as far as the producer, this kind of sets a tone for, like, the kind of movies I want to do. But it's got to be worthy of being on the big screen. That's the catch. Mm-hmm. And you look at movies like The Town. The Town is, that's a character drama every day of the week. But it's masked cleverly, and this heist drama, and it's exciting to watch, and it's visual. But ultimately, that could be an episode of XYZ on TV, because there's such great drama on TV now. But no studio is going to say, like, yes, we're going to make this character drama. It's got to be some sort of, like, big element to it. And The Town is a great sort of 70s kind of feel to it, if you ask me. It has that French Connection.
Sidney Lumet kind of.
Yeah, any of that kind of stuff. Amazing. And I still think there's an appetite for people out there to like those movies and want to see those movies. It's just not, it doesn't make business sense.
But that was a big hit, though. Minds.
But yeah, made loads of dough, which is awesome. Hurt Locker doesn't make tons of cash, but that's another kind of movie that, you know, I like doing.
Right. And I imagine, too, a movie like that, it's just going to stand the test of time. Like, those people will make their money.
Right. And that's important to me as well. That's nice to know, or that you can never control that. You don't know what's going to stand the test of time. But that's at least a goal to aim towards. I'd love to do those.
Right, finding that balance of art and commerce.
Yeah, I think so.
Having the experience of producing, I was wondering, knowing the behind the scenes and the technical side more so, does that help you as an actor?
Sure, I guess, but not as like the actual producing and developing material and having a company, a production company. Yeah, just the business, I see the business a little bit differently. I don't just look at it in terms of, like, here's a script, here's a great director, let's go shoot this. I look at in a much broader perspective on things.
Right.
And so now I'm, like, always meeting with writers and directors for different reasons and developing stories. And, yeah, I love it. I really, really enjoy it. It's a different avenue of creativity.
Right. You've worked with some really great directors the past few years. What kind of director usually speaks to you, you know, when you know, having those conversations that you'd hit it off?
I feel like when we're on the same page of the material, same page of, because I think like a director, I think like a writer and a producer, I think first and foremost like an audience member, and that's how I communicate with any director, because I don't make it selfishly, like, even if it's like I'm in every frame, like Kill the Messenger, it's still about, like, it's your film, we have to tell, how can I help you as Gary Webb, help you tell your story, or whatever it might be. So, with the director, I just sit over a cup of coffee like we are right now and talk about things in those terms. And if we get on the same page, then it's great. And then I throw out some ideas of, like, all I have to do is focus on a microcosm of what the director has to look at. He has to look at a lot of things. All I got to do is focus on the one guy and how to make him interesting and truthful and a lot of things.
So. Great. I got a final question for you. Because like you said, you think like a director. Do you ever see yourself directing?
Yeah, I do. That's... I'm slightly terrified of it, but yeah, I think at some point I'd love to give that a go, for sure.
Cool. Well, I look forward to seeing that.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, man.
No problem. Have a great day.
Yeah, you as well.
That's our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. In just a few moments, we will reveal our heroes of the week. But first, I want to tell you our interstitial music is from David Rosen, opening and closing theme from the band Party Bats. Our announcer is Dave DeAndrea, art designed by Jen Lindemann at iCandy Art. The show is written and produced by me, Scott Beggs, and Jeff LeTulip. And our executive producer is Neil Miller. So, Jeff, tell us your hero of the week.
First of all, I didn't like the French flair with which you said my last name.
Tulip.
Let's go on record about that. I'm late to the party on this one, but it was just this week that I finally got around to watching Captain America: The Winter Soldier, and my heroes of the week are Joe and Anthony Russo, who, out of absolutely nowhere, ended up becoming like amazing action directors. Never saw it coming. Spent some time with them on the set of Community once and seemed like very smart, very cool guys. Had no idea they had that in them, was blown away.
Yeah, Kevin actually did the commentary on Captain America: The Winter Soldier, and his takeaway was that both of them and the writers all had this amazing group rapport, and you can actually tell through in their commentary track on the DVD, like, how in sync they are with each other.
It was, I think, without question, the best action and set pieces of the entire Marvel Universe so far.
Yeah, a lot of clarity to all of them. Mm-hmm. So, my hero this week is people who don't know what they're talking about, because there's been so much news recently, and whenever I see breaking news, the first thing I want to see is hordes of people offering their opinion, despite not knowing any facts about the case. So... Thank you to all of you who make that world possible.
And can we make a special Hero of the Week mention for people whose biggest problem today was getting free music on September 11th?
Yeah, you had a rough one today. You certainly can't easily delete those songs from your
Feel so bad for you.
It's tough. To be fair, I think if it had been any other band but you two, or maybe like if it was Creed, you can imagine the outrage as well. But
then it would have been justified.
It would have been fine. We would have gone and played kickball. So for everyone at Broken Projector, I'm Scott Beggs reminding you that the plaque for alternates is in the ladies' room.
And I'm Jeff LaTulip reminding you that no, there's two F's in Jeff, boys.
And it's pronounced LaTulip. We'll see you next Friday.
Hate you. Los Angeles is a fuckhole today.